A strange thing happened then. The speaker agreed with her that she had made a mistake that night, and she knew when he said the words that it was true, that his judgment was correct. And yet she felt strangely healed, as if simply speaking her mistake were enough to purge some of the pain of it. For the first time, then, she caught a glimpse of what the power of speaking might be. It wasn't a matter of confession, penance, and absolution like the priests offered. It was something else entirely, telling the story of who she was and then realizing that she was no longer the same person, that she had made a mistake, and the mistake had changed her, and now she would not make the mistake again because she had become someone else, someone less afraid, someone more compassionate. If I'm not that frightened girl who heard her brother in desperate pain and dared not to go to him, who am I? But the water flowing through the grillwork under the fence held no answers. Maybe she couldn't know who she was today. Maybe it was enough to know that she was no longer who she was before. Still, the speaker lay there on the grama, looking at the clouds coming darkly out of the west. "I've told you all I know," Ella said. "I told you what was in those files, the Descalada information. That's all I know." "No, it isn't," said the speaker. "It is, I promise." "Do you mean to say that you obeyed her? That when your mother told you not to do any theoretical work, you simply turned off your mind and did what she wanted?" Ella giggled. "She thinks so." "But you didn't." "I'm a scientist, even if she isn't." "She was once," said the speaker. "She passed her tests when she was 13. "I know," said Ella. "And she used to share information with Pippo before he died." "I know that, too. It was just Libo that she hated." "So tell me, Ella, what have you discovered in your theoretical work?" "I haven't discovered any answers, but at least I know what some of the questions are. That's a start, isn't it? Nobody else is asking questions. It's so funny, isn't it? Miro says the Framling Xenologers are always pestering him and Wanda for more information, more data, and yet the law forbids them from learning anything more. And yet not a single Framling Xenobiologist has ever asked us for any information. They all just study the biosphere on their own planets and don't ask Mother a single question. I'm the only one asking, and nobody cares." "I care," said the speaker. "I need to know what the questions are." "Okay, here's one. We have a herd of cabra here inside the fence. The cabra can't jump the fence. They don't even touch it. I've examined and tagged every single cabra in the herd. And you know something? There's not one male. They're all female." "Bad luck," said the speaker. "You'd think they would have at least one male inside." "It doesn't matter," said Ella. "I don't know if there are any males. In the last 5 years, every single adult cabra has given birth at least once, and not one of them has mated." "Maybe they clone," said the speaker. "The offspring is not genetically identical to the mother." "That much research I could sneak into the lab without Mother noticing." "There is some kind of gene transfer going on." "Hermaphrodites?" "No. Pure female. No male sexual organs at all." "Does that qualify as an important question?" "Somehow the cabras are having some kind of genetic exchange without sex." "The theological implications alone are astounding." "Don't make fun." "Of which? Science or theology?" "Either one. Do you want to hear more of my questions or not?" "I do," said the speaker. "Then try this. The grass you're lying on, we call it grama. All the water snakes are hatched here. Little worms so small you can hardly see them. They eat the grass down to the nub and eat each other too, shedding skin each time they grow larger. Then all of a sudden, when the grass is completely slimy with their dead skin, all the snakes slither off into the river and they never come back out." He wasn't a xenobiologist. He didn't get the implication right away. "The water snakes hatch here," she explained. "But they don't come back out of the water to lay their eggs. So they mate here before they go into the water." Fine, of course, obviously. I've seen the mating. That's not the problem. The problem is, why are they water snakes? He still didn't get it. Look, they're completely adapted to life underwater. They have gills along with lungs. They're superb swimmers. They have fins for guidance. They're completely evolved for adult life in the water. Why would they ever have evolved that way if they are born on land, mate on land, and reproduce on land? As far as evolution is concerned, anything that happens after you reproduce is completely irrelevant, except if you nurture your young, and the water snakes definitely don't nurture. Living in the water does nothing to enhance their ability to survive until they reproduce. They could slither into the water and drown, and it wouldn't matter because reproduction is over. Yes, said the speaker. I see now. There are little clear eggs in the water, though. I've never seen a water snake lay them, but since there's no other animal in or near the river large enough to lay the eggs, it seems logical that they're water snake eggs. Only these big clear eggs, a centimeter across, they're completely sterile. The nutrients are there, everything's ready, but there's no embryo. Nothing. Some of them have a gamete, half a set of genes in a cell, ready to combine, but not a single one was alive. And we've never found water snake eggs on land. One day, there's nothing but grama, getting riper and riper. The next day, the grama stalks are crawling with baby water snakes. Does this sound like a question worth exploring? It sounds like spontaneous generation to me. Yes, well, I'd like to find enough information to test alternate hypotheses, but Mother won't let me. I asked her about this one, and she made me take over the whole amaranth testing process so I wouldn't have time to muck around in the river. And another question. Why are there so few species here? On every other planet, even some of the nearly desert ones, like Trondheim, there are thousands of different species, at least in the water. Here, there's hardly a handful, as far as I can tell. The Zingadora are the only birds we've ever seen. The suck flies are the only flies. The cabra are the only ruminants eating the capim grass. Except for the cabras, the piggies are the only large animals we've seen. Only one species of tree, only one species of grass on the prairie, the capim, and the only other competing plant is the trepesa, a long vine that wanders along the ground for meters and meters. The Zingadora make their nests out of the vine. That's it. The Zingadora eat the suck flies, and nothing else. The suck flies eat the algae along the edge of the river, and are garbage, and that's it. Nothing eats the Zingadora. Nothing eats the cabra. Very limited, said the speaker. Impossibly limited. There are 10,000 ecological niches here that are completely unfilled. There's no way that evolution could leave this world so sparse. Unless there was a disaster. Exactly. Something that wiped out all but a handful of species that were able to adapt. Yes, said Ella. You see? And I have proof. The cabras have a huddling behavior pattern. When you come up on them, when they smell you, they circle with the adults facing inward so they can kick out at the intruder and protect the young. Lots of herd animals do that. Protect them from what? The piggies are completely sylvan. They never hunt on the prairie. Whatever the predator was that forced the cabra to develop that behavior pattern, it's gone. And only recently, in the last 100,000 years, the last million years maybe. There's no evidence of any meteor falls more recent than 20 million years, said the speaker. No. That kind of disaster would kill off all the big animals and plants and leave hundreds of small ones, or maybe kill all land life and leave only the sea. But land, sea, all the environments were stripped, and yet some big creatures survived. No, I think it was a disease that struck across all species boundaries, that could adapt itself to any living thing. Of course, we wouldn't notice that disease now because all the species left alive have adapted to it. It would be part of their regular life pattern. The only way we'd notice the disease is If we caught it, said the speaker, the descolada. You see, everything comes back to the descolada. My grandparents found a way to stop it from killing humans, but it took the best genetic manipulation. The cabra, the water snakes, they also found ways to adapt, and I doubt it was with dietary supplements. I think it all ties in together. The weird reproductive anomalies, the emptiness of the ecosystem, it all comes back to the descolada bodies. And Mother won't let me examine them. She won't let me study what they are, how they work, how they might be involved with the piggies. Well, of course, but not just them, all the animals. The speaker looked like he was suppressing excitement, as if she had explained something difficult. The night that Pippo died, she locked the files showing all her current work, and she locked the files containing all the Descolada research. Whatever she showed Pippo had to do with the Descolada bodies, and it had to do with the piggies.
That's when she locked the files? Asked Ella.
Yes, yes.
Then I'm right, aren't I?
Yes, he said. Thank you. You've helped me more than you know. Does this mean that you'll speak Father's death soon? The speaker looked at her carefully. You don't want me to speak your father, really. You want me to speak your mother.
She isn't dead.
But you know I can't possibly speak Marcaun without explaining why he married Novinia, and why they stayed married all those years.
That's right. I want all the secrets opened up. I want all the files unlocked. I don't want anything hidden.
You don't know what you're asking, said the speaker. You don't know how much pain it will cause if all the secrets come out.
Take a look at my family, speaker, she answered. How can the truth cause any more pain than the secrets have already caused?
He smiled at her, but it was not a mirthful smile. It was affectionate, even pitying. You're right, he said. Completely right. But you may have trouble realizing that when you hear the whole story. I know the whole story as far as it can be known. That's what everybody thinks, and nobody's right.
When will you have the speaking?
As soon as I can.
Then why not now?
Today? What are you waiting for?
I can't do anything until I talk to the piggies.
You're joking, aren't you? Nobody can talk to the piggies except the Xenadors. That's by congressional order. Nobody can get past that.
Yes, said the speaker. That's why it's going to be hard.
Not hard. Impossible.
Maybe, he said.
He stood. So did she. Ella, you've helped me tremendously, taught me everything I could have hoped to learn from you, just like Oyado did. But he didn't like what I did with the things he taught me, and now he thinks I betrayed him.
He's a kid. I'm 18.
The speaker nodded, put his hand on her shoulder, squeezed. We're all right then. We're friends. She was almost sure there was irony in what he said. Irony, and perhaps a plea.
Yes, she insisted. We're friends. Always.
He nodded again, turned away, pushed the boat from shore, and splashed after it through the reeds and muck. Once the boat was fairly afloat, he sat down and extended the oars, rowed, and then looked up and smiled at her. Ella smiled back, but the smile could not convey the elation she felt, the perfect relief. He had listened to everything and understood everything, and he would make everything all right. She believed that, believed it so completely that she didn't even notice that it was the source of her sudden happiness. She knew only that she had spent an hour with the speaker for the dead, and now she felt more alive than she had in years. She retrieved her shoes, put them back on her feet, and walked home. Mother would still be at the Biologista station, but Ella didn't want to work this afternoon. She wanted to go home and fix dinner. That was always solitary work. She hoped no one would talk with her. She hoped there'd be no problem she was expected to solve. Let this feeling linger forever. Ella was only home for a few minutes, however, when Miro burst into the kitchen.
Ella, he said, have you seen the speaker for the dead? Yes, she said. On the river. Where on the river? If she told him where they had met, he'd know that it wasn't a chance meeting. Why? She asked.
Listen, Ella, this is no time to be suspicious, please. I've got to find him. We've left messages for him. The computer can't find him.
He was rowing downriver toward home. He's probably going to be at his house soon. Muro rushed from the kitchen into the front room. Ella heard him tapping at the terminal. Then he came back in.
Thanks, he said. Don't expect me home for dinner.
What's so urgent?
Nothing.
It was ridiculous to say nothing when Muro was obviously agitated and hurried that they both burst out laughing at once.
Okay, said Muro. It isn't nothing. It's something. But I can't talk about it, okay?
Okay. But soon, all the secrets will be known, Muro.
What I don't understand is why he didn't get our message. I mean, the computer was paging him. Doesn't he wear an implant in his ear? The computer's supposed to be able to reach him. Of course, maybe he had it turned off.
No, said Ella. The light was on. Muro cocked his head and squinted at her.
You didn't see that tiny red light on his ear implant, not if he just happened to be out rowing in the middle of the river.
He came to shore. We talked.
What about?
Ella smiled.
Nothing, she said.
He smiled back, but he looked annoyed all the same. She understood. It's all right for you to have secrets from me, but not for me to have secrets from you. Is that it, Muro? He didn't argue about it, though. He was in too much of a hurry. Had to go find the speaker, and now. And he wouldn't be home for dinner. Ella had a feeling the speaker might get to talk to the piggies sooner than she had thought possible. For a moment, she was elated. The waiting would be over. Then the elation passed, and something else took its place. A sick fear. A nightmare of China's papai, dear Libo, lying dead on the hillside, torn apart by the piggies. Only it wasn't Libo, the way she had always imagined the grisly scene. It was Muro.
No.
No, it wasn't Muro. It was the speaker. It was the speaker who would be tortured to death.
No,
she whispered. Then she shivered, and the nightmare left her mind. She went back to trying to spice and season the pasta, so it would taste like something better than amaranth glue.
Chapter 14. Renegades. Leaf Eater. Human says that when your brothers die, you bury them in the dirt, and then make your houses out of that dirt. Laughs. Miro. No, we never dig where people are buried. Leaf Eater. Becomes rigid with agitation. Then your dead don't do you any good at all. Wanda Kenyatta Figuera Mukumbi. Dialogue Transcripts. 103-0. 1969-4-13-111.
Ender had thought they might have some trouble getting him through the gate, but Wanda palmed the box. Miro opened the gate, and the three of them walked through. No challenge. It must be as Ella had implied. No one wanted to get out of the compound, so no serious security was needed. Whether that suggested that people were content to stay in Milagre, or that they were afraid of the piggies, or that they hated their imprisonment so much that they had to pretend the fence wasn't there, Ender could not begin to guess. Both Wanda and Miro were very tense, almost frightened. That was understandable, of course, since they were breaking congressional rules to let him come. But Ender suspected there was more to it than that. Miro's tension was coupled with eagerness, a sense of hurry. He might be frightened, but he wanted to see what would happen, wanted to go ahead. Wanda held back, walked a measured step, and her coldness was not just fear, but hostility as well. She did not trust him. So Ender was not surprised when she stepped behind the large tree that grew nearest the gate and waited for Miro and Ender to follow her. Ender saw how Miro looked annoyed for a moment, then controlled himself. His mask of uninvolvement was as cool as a human being could hope for. Ender found himself comparing Miro to the boys he had known in battle school, sizing him up as a comrade in arms, and thought Miro might have done well there. Wanda, too, but for different reasons. She held herself responsible for what was happening, even though Ender was an adult and she was much younger. She did not defer to him at all, Whatever she was afraid of, it was not authority. "Here?" asked Miro blandly. "Or not at all," said Wanda. Ender folded himself to sit at the base of the tree. "This is Reuter's tree, isn't it?" he asked. They took it calmly, of course, but their momentary pause told him that yes, he had surprised them by knowing something about a past that they surely regarded as their own. "I may be a Framling here," Ender said silently, "but I don't have to be an ignorant one." "Yes," said Wanda. "He's the totem they seem to get the most direction from. Lately, the last 7 or 8 years, they've never let us see the rituals in which they talk to their ancestors, but it seems to involve drumming on the trees with heavy polished sticks. We hear them at night sometimes. Sticks made of fallen wood. We assume so. Why? Because they have no stone or metal tools to cut the wood, isn't that right? Besides, if they worship the trees, they couldn't very well cut them down. We don't think they worship the trees. It's totemic. They stand for dead ancestors. They plant them with the bodies." Wanda had wanted to stop to talk or question him, but Ender had no intention of letting her believe she, or Miro for that matter, was in charge of this expedition. Ender intended to talk to the piggies himself. He had never prepared for a speaking by letting someone else determine his agenda, and he wasn't going to begin now. Besides, he had information they didn't have. He knew Ella's theory. "And anywhere else?" he asked. "Do they plant trees at any other time?" They looked at each other. "Not that we've seen," said Miro. Ender was not merely curious. He was still thinking of what Ella had told him about reproductive anomalies. "And do the trees also grow by themselves? Are seedlings and saplings scattered through the forest?" Wanda shook her head. "We really don't have any evidence of the trees being planted anywhere but in the corpses of the dead. At least, all the trees we know of are quite old, except these three out here." "Four if we don't hurry," said Miro. Ah, here was the tension between them. Miro's sense of urgency was to save a piggy from being planted at the base of another tree, while Wanda was concerned about something quite different. They had revealed enough of themselves to him. Now he could let her interrogate him. He sat up straight and tipped his head back to look up into the leaves of the tree above him, the spreading branches, the pale green of photosynthesis that confirmed the convergence, the inevitability of evolution on every world. Here was the center of all of Ella's paradoxes. Evolution on this world was obviously well within the pattern that xenobiologists had seen on all the 100 worlds, and yet, somewhere, the pattern had broken down, collapsed. The piggies were one of a few dozen species that had survived the collapse. What was the Descolada, and how had the piggies adapted to it? He had meant to turn the conversation to say, "Why are we here behind this tree?" That would invite Wanda's questions, but at that moment, his head tilted back, the soft green leaves moving gently in an almost imperceptible breeze, he felt a powerful déjà vu. He had looked up into these leaves before, recently, but that was impossible. There were no large trees on Trondheim, and none grew within the compound of Milagre. Why did the sunlight through the leaves feel so familiar to him? "Speaker," said Miro. "Yes," he said, allowing himself to be drawn out of his momentary reverie. "We didn't want to bring you out here," Miro said it firmly, and with his body so oriented toward Wanda's that Ender understood that, in fact, Miro had wanted to bring him out here, but was including himself in Wanda's reluctance in order to show her that he was one with her. "You are in love with each other," Ender said silently. "And tonight, if I speak Markaun's death, I will have to tell you that your brother and sister. I have to drive the wedge of the incest taboo between you, and you will surely hate me. You're going to see some..." Wanda could not bring herself to say it. Miro smiled. "We call them questionable activities. They began with Pipo accidentally, but Libo did it deliberately, and we are continuing his work. It is careful, gradual. We didn't just discard the congressional rules about this. But there were crises, and we had to help. A few years ago, for instance, the piggies were running short of maquillos, the bark worms they mostly lived on then. You're going to tell him that first? Asked Wanda. Ah, thought Ender. It isn't as important to her to maintain the illusion of solidarity as it is to him. He's here partly to speak Lebo's death, said Miro, and this is what happened right before. We have no evidence of a causal relationship. Let me discover causal relationships, said Ender quietly. Tell me what happened when the piggies got hungry. It was the wives who were hungry, they said. Miro ignored Wanda's anxiety. You see, the males gather food for the females and the young, and so there wasn't enough to go around. They kept hinting about how they would have to go to war, about how they would probably all die. Miro shook his head. They seemed almost happy about it. Wanda stood up. He hasn't even promised, hasn't promised anything. What do you want me to promise? Asked Ender. Not to let any of this... Not to tell on you? Asked Ender. She nodded, though she plainly resented the childish phrase. I won't promise any such thing, said Ender. My business is telling. She whirled on Miro. You see? Miro, in turn, looked frightened. You can't tell. They'll seal the gate. They'll never let us through. And you'd have to find another line of work? Asked Ender. Wanda looked at him with contempt. Is that all you think xenology is, a job? That's another intelligent species there in the woods. Ramen, not Varelsa, and they must be known. Ender did not answer, but his gaze did not leave her face. It's like the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, said Miro. The piggies, they're like the buggers, only smaller, weaker, more primitive. We need to study them, yes, but that isn't enough. You can study beasts and not care a bit when one of them drops dead or gets eaten up. But these are, they're like us. We can't just study their hunger, observe their destruction in war. We know them. We love them, said Ender. Yes, said Wanda defiantly. But if you left them, if you weren't here at all, they wouldn't disappear, would they? No, said Miro. I told you he'd be just like the committee, said Wanda. Ender ignored her. What would it cost them if you left? It's like... Miro struggled for words. It's as if you could go back to old Earth, back before the Xenocide, before star travel, and you said to them, you can travel among the stars, you can live in other worlds, and then showed them 1,000 little miracles, lights that turn on from switches, steel, even simple things, pots to hold water, agriculture. They see you, they know what you are, they know that they can become what you are, do all the things that you do. What do they say? Take this away, don't show us, let us live our nasty, short, brutish little lives, let evolution take its course. No, they say, give us, teach us, help us. And you say, I can't, and then you go away. It's too late, said Miro. Don't you understand? They've already seen the miracles. They've already seen us fly here. They've seen us be tall and strong with magical tools and knowledge of things they never dreamed of. It's too late to tell them goodbye and go. They know what is possible. And the longer we stay, the more they try to learn. And the more they learn, the more we see how learning helps them. And if you have any kind of compassion, if you understand that they're human. Ramen, anyway. They're our children. Do you understand that? Ender smiled. What man among you, if his son asks for bread, gives him a stone? Wanda nodded. That's it. The congressional rules say we have to give them stones, even though we have so much bread. Ender stood up. Well, let's go on. Wanda wasn't ready. You haven't promised. Have you read The Hive Queen and the Hegemon? I have, said Miro. Can you conceive of anyone choosing to call himself speaker for the dead and then doing anything to harm these little ones, these pequeninos? Wanda's anxiety visibly eased, but her hostility was no less. You're slick, Señor Andro, speaker for the dead. You're very clever. You remind him of the Hive Queen and speak scripture to me out of the side of your mouth. I speak to everyone in the language they understand, said Ender. That isn't being slick, it's being clear. So you'll do whatever you want, as long as it doesn't hurt the piggies. Wanda sneered. In your judgment. I have no one else's judgment to use. He walked away from her, out of the shade of the spreading limbs of the tree, heading for the woods that waited atop the hill. They followed him, running to catch up. I have to tell you, said Miro, the piggies have been asking for you. They believe you are the very same speaker who wrote The Hive Queen and the Hegemon. They've read it? Well, they've pretty well incorporated it into their religion, actually. They treat the printout we gave them like a holy book, and now they claim the Hive Queen herself is talking to them. Ender glanced at him. What does she say? He asked. That you're the real speaker, and that you've got the Hive Queen with you, and that you're going to bring her to live with them and teach them all about metal, and... It's really crazy stuff. That's the worst thing. They have such impossible expectations of you. It might be simple wish fulfillment on their part, as Miro obviously believed, but Ender knew that from her cocoon the Hive Queen had been talking to someone. How do they say the Hive Queen talks to them? Wanda was on the other side of him now. Not to them, just to Rooter. And Rooter talks to them. It's all part of their system of totems. We've always tried to play along with it and act as if we believed it. How condescending of you, said Ender. It's standard anthropological practice, said Miro. You're so busy pretending to believe them, there isn't a chance in the world you could learn anything from them. For a moment, they lagged behind so that he actually entered the forest alone. Then they ran to catch up with him. We've devoted our lives to learning about them, Miro said. Ender stopped. Not from them. They were just inside the trees. The spotty light through the leaves made their faces unreadable, but he knew what their faces would tell him. Annoyance, resentment, contempt. How dare this unqualified stranger question their professional attitude? This is how. You're cultural supremacists to the core. You'll perform your questionable activities to help out the poor little piggies, but there isn't a chance in the world you'll notice when they have something to teach you. Like what? Demanded Wanda. Like how to murder their greatest benefactor, torture him to death after he saved the lives of dozens of their wives and children. So why do you tolerate it? Why are you here helping them after what they did? Miro slipped in between Wanda and Ender. Protecting her, thought Ender, or else keeping her from revealing her weaknesses. We're professionals. We understand that cultural differences, which we can't explain, you understand that the piggies are animals, and you no more condemn them for murdering Libo and Pipo than you would condemn a cabra for chewing up capim. That's right, said Miro. Ender smiled. And that's why you'll never learn anything from them, because you think of them as animals. We think of them as ramen, said Wanda, pushing in front of Miro. Obviously, she was not interested in being protected. You treat them as if they were not responsible for their own actions, said Ender. Ramen are responsible for what they do. What are you going to do? Asked Wanda sarcastically. Come in and put them on trial? I'll tell you this. The piggies have learned more about me from dead Rooter than you have learned from having me with you. What's that supposed to mean? That you really are the original speaker? Miro obviously regarded it as the most ridiculous proposition imaginable. And I suppose you really do have a bunch of buggers up there in your starship circling Lusitania so you can bring them down, and what it means, interrupted Wanda, is that this amateur thinks he's better qualified to deal with the piggies than we are. And as far as I'm concerned, that's proof that we should never have agreed to bring him to... At that moment, Wanda stopped talking. For a piggy had emerged from the underbrush. Smaller than Ender had expected. Its odor, while not wholly unpleasant, was certainly stronger than Jane's computer simulation could ever imply. Too late, Ender murmured. I think we're already meeting. The piggy's expression, if he had one, was completely unreadable to Ender. Miro and Wanda, however, could understand something of his unspoken language. He's astonished, Wanda murmured. By telling Ender that she understood what he did not, she was putting him in his place. That was fine. Ender knew he was a novice here. He also hoped, however, that he had stirred them a little from their normal, unquestioned ways of thinking. It was obvious that they were following in well-established patterns. If he was to get any real help from them, they would have to break out of those old patterns and reach new conclusions. "Leaf Eater," said Miro. Leaf Eater did not take his eyes off Ender. "Speaker for the dead," he said. "We brought him," said Wanda. Leaf Eater turned and disappeared among the bushes. "What does that mean?" Ender asked, "that he left." "You mean you haven't already figured it out?" asked Wanda. "Whether you like it or not," said Ender, "the piggies want to speak to me, and I will speak to them. I think it will work out better if you help me understand what's going on, or don't you understand it either?" He watched them struggle with their annoyance. And then, to Ender's relief, Miro made a decision. Instead of answering with hauteur, he spoke simply, mildly. "No, we don't understand it. We're still playing guessing games with the piggies. They ask us questions, we ask them questions, and to the best of our ability, neither they nor we have ever deliberately revealed a thing. We don't even ask them the questions whose answers we really want to know, for fear that they'll learn too much about us from our questions." Wanda was not willing to go along with Miro's decision to cooperate. "We know more than you will in 20 years, she said. "And you're crazy if you think you can duplicate what we know in a 10-minute briefing in the forest." "I don't need to duplicate what you know," Ender said. "You don't think so?" asked Wanda. "Because I have you with me," Ender smiled. Miro understood and took it as a compliment. He smiled back. "Here's what we know, and it isn't much. Leaf Eater probably isn't glad to see you. There's a schism between him and a piggy named Human. When they thought we weren't going to bring you, Leaf Eater was sure he had won. Now his victory is taken away. Maybe we saved Human's life." "And cost Leaf Eater his?" asked Ender. "Who knows? My gut feeling is that Human's future is on the line, but Leaf Eater's isn't. Leaf Eater's just trying to make Human fail, not succeed himself." "But you don't know." "That's the kind of thing we never ask about." Miro smiled again. "And you're right. It's so much a habit that we usually don't even notice that we're not asking." Wanda was angry. "He's right? He hasn't even seen us at work, and suddenly he's a critic of..." But Ender had no interest in watching them squabble. He strode off in the direction Leaf Eater had gone and let them follow as they would. And of course they did, leaving their argument for later. As soon as Ender knew they were walking with him, he began to question them again. "These questionable activities you've carried out," he said as he walked. "You introduced new food into their diet?" "We taught them how to eat the Merdona root," said Wanda. She was crisp and businesslike, but at least she was speaking to him. She wasn't going to let her anger keep her from being part of what was obviously going to be a crucial meeting with the piggies. "How to nullify the cyanide content by soaking it and drying it in the sun. That was the short-term solution." "The long-term solution was some of Mother's cast-off amaranth adaptations," said Miro. "She made a batch of amaranth that was so well adapted to Lusitania that it wasn't very good for humans. Too much Lusitanian protein structure, not enough earthborn. But that sounded about right for the piggies. I got Ella to give me some of the cast-off specimens without letting her know it was important." "Don't kid yourself about what Ella does and doesn't know," Ender said silently. "Lebo gave it to them, taught them how to plant it, then how to grind it, make flour, turn it into bread. Nasty-tasting stuff, but it gave them a diet directly under their control for the first time ever. They've been fat and sassy ever since." Wanda's voice was bitter. "But they killed Father right after the first loaves were taken to the wives." Ender walked in silence for a few moments, trying to make sense of this. The piggies killed Lebo immediately after he saved them from starvation? Unthinkable, and yet it happened. How could such a society evolve, killing those who contributed most to its survival? They should do the opposite. They should reward the valuable ones by enhancing their opportunity to reproduce. That's how communities improve their chances of surviving as a group. How could the piggies possibly survive murdering those who contribute most to their survival? And yet there were human precedents. These children, Miro and Wanda, with the questionable activities, they were better and wiser in the long run than the Starways committee that made the rules. But if they were caught, they would be taken from their homes to another world. Already a death sentence in a way, since everyone they knew would be dead before they could ever return, and they would be tried and punished, probably imprisoned. Neither their ideas nor their genes would propagate, and society would be impoverished by it. Still, Just because humans did it too did not make it sensible. Besides, the arrest and imprisonment of Miro and Wanda, if it ever happened, would make sense if you viewed humans as a single community and the piggies as their enemies. If you thought that anything that helped the piggies survive was somehow a menace to humanity, then the punishment of people who enhanced the piggies' culture would be designed not to protect the piggies, but to keep the piggies from developing. At that moment, Ender saw clearly that the rules governing human contact with the piggies did not really function to protect the piggies at all. They functioned to guarantee human superiority and power. From that point of view, by performing their questionable activities, Miro and Wanda were traitors to the self-interest of their own species. "Renegades," he said aloud. "What?" said Miro. "What did you say?" "Renegades. Those who have denied their own people and claimed the enemy as their own." "Ah," said Miro. "We're not," said Wanda. "Yes, we are," said Miro. "I haven't denied my humanity." "The way Bishop Peregrino defines it, we denied our humanity long ago," said Miro. "But the way I define it," she began. "The way you define it," said Ender, "the piggies are also human. That's why you're a renegade." "I thought you said we treated the piggies like animals," Wanda said. "When you don't hold them accountable, when you don't ask them direct questions, when you try to deceive them, then you treat them like animals." "In other words," said Miro, "when we do follow the committee rules." "Yes," said Wanda. "Yes, that's right. We are renegades." "And you," said Miro, "why are you a renegade?" "Oh, the human race kicked me out a long time ago. And that's how I got to be a speaker for the dead." With that, they arrived at the piggies' clearing.
Mother wasn't at dinner and neither was Miro. That was fine with Ella. When neither one of them was there, Ella was stripped of her authority. She couldn't keep control over the younger children. And yet, neither Miro nor Mother took Ella's place either. Nobody obeyed Ella, and nobody else tried to keep order. So it was quieter, easier when they stayed away. Not that the little ones were particularly well-behaved even now. They just resisted her less. She only had to yell at Grego a couple of times to keep him from poking and kicking Quara under the table. And today, both Keen and Oyado were keeping to themselves. None of the normal bickering. Until the meal was over. Keen leaned back in his chair and smiled maliciously at Oyado. "So you're the one who taught that spy how to get into Mother's files." Oyado turned to Ella. "You left Keen's face open again, Ella. You've got to learn to be tidier." It was Oliado's way of appealing through humor for Ella's intervention. King did not want Oliado to have any help. "Ella's not on your side this time, Oliado. Nobody's on your side. You helped that sneaking spy get into Mother's files, and that makes you as guilty as he is. He's the devil's servant, and so are you." Ella saw the fury in Oliado's body. She had a momentary image in her mind of Oliado flinging his plate at King. But the moment passed. Oliado calmed himself. "I'm sorry," Oliado said. "I didn't mean to do it." He was giving in to King. He was admitting King was right. "I hope," said Ella, "that you mean that you're sorry that you didn't mean to do it. I hope that you aren't apologizing for helping the speaker for the dead." "Of course he's apologizing for helping the spy," said King. "Because," said Ella, "we should all help Speaker all we can." King jumped to his feet, leaned across the table to shout in her face. "How can you say that? He was violating Mother's privacy. He was finding out her secrets. He was..." To her surprise, Ella found herself also on her feet, shoving him back across the table, shouting back at him and louder. "Mother's secrets are the cause of half the poison in this house. Mother's secrets are what's making us all sick, including her. So maybe the only way to make things right here is to steal all her secrets and get them out in the open where we can kill them." She stopped shouting. Both Keen and Oliado stood before her, pressed against the far wall as if her words were bullets and they were being executed. Quietly, intensely, Ella went on. "As far as I'm concerned, the speaker for the dead is the only chance we have to become a family again, and Mother's secrets are the only barrier standing in his way. So today, I told him everything I knew about what's in Mother's files because I want to give him every shred of truth that I can find. Then you're the worst traitor of all, said King. His voice was trembling. He was about to cry. I say that helping the Speaker for the Dead is an act of loyalty, Ella answered. The only real treason is obeying Mother, because what she wants, what she has worked for all her life, is her own self-destruction and the destruction of this family. To Ella's surprise, it was not King, but Oliado who wept. His tear glands did not function, of course, having been removed when his eyes were installed, so there was no moistening of his eyes to warn of the onset of crying. Instead, he doubled over with a sob, then sank down along the wall until he sat on the floor, his head between his knees, sobbing and sobbing. Ella understood why. Because she had told him that his love for the Speaker was not disloyal, that he had not sinned. And he believed her when she told him that. He knew that it was true. Then she looked up from Oliado to see Mother standing in the doorway. Ella felt herself go weak inside, trembling at the thought of what Mother must have overheard. But Mother did not seem angry, just a little sad and very tired. She was looking at Oliado. Keen's outrage found his voice. Did you hear what Ella was saying? He asked. Yes, said Mother, never taking her eyes from Oliado. And for all I know, she might be right. Ella was no less unnerved than King. Go to your rooms, children, Mother said quietly. I need to talk to Oliado. Ella beckoned to Grego and Clara, who slid off their chairs and scurried to Ella's side, eyes wide with awe at the unusual goings-on. After all, even Father had never been able to make Oliado cry. She led them out of the kitchen, back to their bedroom. She heard King walk down the hall and go into his own room, slam the door, and hurl himself onto his bed. And in the kitchen, Oliado's sobs faded, calmed, ended, as Mother, for the first time since he lost his eyes, held him in her arms and comforted him, shedding her own silent tears into his hair as she rocked him back and forth.
Miro did not know what to make of the Speaker for the Dead. Somehow he had always imagined a speaker to be very much like a priest, or rather like a priest was supposed to be. Quiet, contemplative, withdrawn from the world, carefully leaving action and decision to others. Miro had expected him to be wise. He had not expected him to be so intrusive, so dangerous. Yes, he was wise, all right. He kept seeing past pretense, kept saying or doing outrageous things that were, when you thought about it, exactly right. It was as if he were so familiar with the human mind that he could see, right on your face, the desires so deep, the truths so well disguised, that you didn't even know yourself that you had them in you. How many times had Miro stood with Wanda just like this, watching as Libo handled the piggies? But always with Libo they had understood what he was doing. They knew his technique, knew his purpose. The Speaker, however, followed lines of thought that were completely alien to Miro. Even though he wore a human shape, it made Miro wonder if Enderer was really a Fremling. He could be as baffling as the piggies. He was as much a Raman as they were, alien, but still not animal. What did the Speaker notice? What did he see? The bow that Arrow carried? The sun-dried pot in which Merdona root soaked and stank? How many of the questionable activities did he recognize, and how many did he think were native practices? The piggies spread out the Hive Queen and the Hegemon. You, said Arrow, you wrote this? Yes, said the Speaker for the Dead. Miro looked at Wanda. Her eyes danced with vindication. So the Speaker is a liar. Human interrupted. The other two, Miro and Wanda, they think you're a liar. Miro immediately looked at the Speaker, but he wasn't glancing at them. Of course they do, he said. It never occurred to them that Rooter might have told you the truth. The speaker's calm words disturbed Miro. Could it be true? After all, people who traveled between star systems skipped decades, often centuries, in getting from one system to another, sometimes as much as half a millennium. It wouldn't take all that many voyages for a person to survive 3,000 years. But that would be too incredible a coincidence for the original Speaker for the Dead to come here. Except that the original Speaker for the Dead was the one who had written The Hive Queen and The Hegemon. He would be interested in the first race of Ramen since the buggers. I don't believe it, Miro told himself. But he had to admit the possibility that it might just be true. Why are they so stupid? Asked Human. Not to know the truth when they hear it. They aren't stupid, said the Speaker. This is how humans are. We question all our beliefs, except for the ones that we really believe, and those we never think to question. They never thought to question the idea that the original Speaker for the Dead died 3,000 years ago, even though they know how star travel prolongs life. But we told them. No, you told them that the Hive Queen told Rooter that I wrote this book. That's why they should have known it was true, said Human. Rooter is wise. He's a father. He would never make a mistake. Miro did not smile, but he wanted to. The speaker thought he was so clever, but now here he was, where all the important questions ended, frustrated by the piggies' insistence that their totem trees could talk to them. Ah, said the speaker, there's so much that we don't understand, and so much that you don't understand. We should tell each other more. Human sat down beside Arrow, sharing the position of honor with him. Arrow gave no sign of minding. Speaker for the Dead, said Human, will you bring the Hive Queen to us? I haven't decided yet, said the speaker. Again, Miro looked at Wanda. Was the speaker insane, hinting that he could deliver what could not be delivered? Then he remembered what the speaker had said about questioning all our beliefs except the ones we really believed. Miro had always taken for granted what everyone knew, that all the buggers had been destroyed. But what if a Hive Queen had survived? What if that was how the Speaker for the Dead had been able to write his book? Because he had a bugger to talk to. It was unlikely in the extreme, but it was not impossible. Miro didn't know for sure that the last bugger had been killed. He only knew that everybody believed it, and that no one in 3,000 years had produced a shred of evidence to the contrary. But even if it was true, how could Human have known it? The simplest explanation was that the piggies had incorporated the powerful story of the Hive Queen and the Hegemon into their religion and were unable to grasp the idea that there were many speakers for the dead and none of them was the author of the book, that all the buggers were dead and no Hive Queen could ever come. That was the simplest explanation, the one easiest to accept. Any other explanation would force him to admit the possibility that Rooter's totem tree somehow talked to the piggies. What will make you decide? Said Human. We give gifts to the wives to win their honor, but you are the wisest of all humans, and we have nothing that you need. You have many things that I need, said the speaker. What? Can't you make better pots than these? Truer arrows? The cape I wear is made from cabra wool. But your clothing is finer. I don't need things like that, said the speaker. What I need are true stories. Human leaned closer, then let his body become rigid in excitement, in anticipation. Oh, speaker, he said, and his voice was powerful with the importance of his words. Will you add our story to the Hive Queen and the Hegemon? I don't know your story, said the speaker. Ask us. Ask us anything. How can I tell your story? I only tell the stories of the dead. We are dead, shouted Human. Miro had never seen him so agitated. We are being murdered every day. Humans are filling up all the worlds. The ships travel through the black of night from star to star to star, filling up every empty place. Here we are on our one little world, watching the sky fill up with humans. The humans build their stupid fence to keep us out, but that is nothing. The sky is our fence. Human leapt upward, startlingly high, for his legs were powerful. Look how the fence throws me back down to the ground. He ran at the nearest tree, bounded up the trunk higher than Miro had ever seen him climb. He shimmied out on a limb and threw himself upward into the air. He hung there for an agonizing moment at the apex of his leap. Then gravity flung him downward onto the hard ground. Miro could hear the breath thrust out of him by the force of the blow. The speaker immediately rushed to Human. Miro was close behind. Human wasn't breathing. "Is he dead?" asked Wanda behind him. "No!" cried a piggy in the male's language. "You can't die! No, no, no!" Miro looked. To his surprise, it was Leaf Eater. "You can't die!" Then Human reached up a feeble hand and touched the speaker's face. He inhaled a deep gasp and then spoke. "You see, Speaker, I would die to climb the wall that keeps us from the stars." In all the years that Miro had known the piggies, in all the years before, they had never once spoken of star travel, never once asked about it. Yet now Miro realized that all the questions they did ask were oriented toward discovering the secret of starflight. The Xenologers had never realized that because they knew without questioning, that the piggies were so remote from the level of culture that could build starships that it would be 1,000 years before such a thing could possibly be in their reach. But their craving for knowledge about metal, about motors, about flying above the ground, it was all their way of trying to find the secret of starflight. Human slowly got to his feet, holding the speaker's hands. Miro realized that in all the years he had known the piggies, never once had a piggy taken him by the hand. He felt a deep regret and the sharp pain of jealousy. Now that Human was clearly not injured, the other piggies crowded close around the speaker. They did not jostle, but they wanted to be near. "Rooter says the Hive Queen knows how to build starships," said Arrow. "Rooter says the Hive Queen will teach us everything," said Cups. "Metal, fire made from rocks, houses made from black water, everything." Speaker raised his hands, fended off their babbling. "If you were all very thirsty and saw that I had water, you'd all ask me for a drink. But what if I knew that the water I had was poisoned?" "There is no poison in the ships that fly to the stars," said Human. "There are many paths to starflight," said the speaker. "Some are better than others. I'll give you everything I can that won't destroy you."
"The Hive Queen promises," said Human.
"And so do I." Human lunged forward, grabbed the speaker by the hair and ears, and pulled him face to face. Miro had never seen such an act of violence. It was what he had dreaded, the decision to murder.
"If we are Ramen," shouted Human into the speaker's face, "then it is ours to decide, not yours. And if we are Varelse, then you might as well kill us all right now, the way you killed all the Hive Queen's sisters."
Miro was stunned. It was one thing for the piggies to decide this was the speaker who wrote the book, but how could they reach the unbelievable conclusion that he was somehow guilty of the Xenocide? Who did they think he was? The monster Ender? And yet there sat the speaker for the dead, tears running down his cheeks, his eyes closed, as if Human's accusation had the force of truth. Human turned his head to speak to Miro.
"What is this water?"
he whispered. Then he touched the speaker's tears. "It's how we show pain or grief or suffering," Miro answered. Manda Shuva suddenly cried out, a hideous cry that Miro had never heard before, like an animal dying.
"That is how we show pain," whispered Human.
"Ah, ah," cried Manda Shuva. "I have seen that water before. In the eyes of Libo and Pipo I saw that water."
One by one, and then all at once, all the other piggies took up the same cry. Miro was terrified, awed, excited all at once. He had no idea what it meant, but the piggies were showing emotions that they had concealed from the Xenologers for 47 years.
"Are they grieving for Papa?" whispered Wanda.
Her eyes, too, glistened with excitement, and her hair was matted with the sweat of fear. Miro said it the moment it occurred to him. "They didn't know until this moment that people and Libo were crying when they died." Miro had no idea what thoughts then went through Wanda's head. He only knew that she turned away, stumbled a few steps, fell to her hands and knees, and wept bitterly. All in all, the coming of the speaker had certainly stirred things up. Miro knelt beside the speaker, whose head was now bowed, his chin pressed against his chest.
"Speaker," Miro said, "¿cómo puede ser? How can it be that you are the first speaker and yet you are also Ender? No puede ser." "She told them more than I ever thought she would," he whispered.
"But the speaker for the dead, the one who wrote this book, he's the wisest man who lived in the age of flight among the stars. While Ender was a murderer, he killed a whole people, a beautiful race of Raman that could have taught us everything."
"Both human, though," whispered the speaker.
Human was near them now, and he spoke a couplet from the hegemon. "Sickness and healing are in every heart. Death and deliverance are in every hand."
"Human," said the speaker, "tell your people not to grieve for what they did in ignorance."
"It was a terrible thing," said Human. "It was our greatest gift.
Tell your people to be quiet and listen to me."
Human shouted a few words, not in the male's language, but in the wives' language, the language of authority. They fell silent, then sat to hear what the speaker would say.
"I'll do everything I can," said the speaker. "But first I have to know you, or how can I tell your story? I have to know you, or how can I know whether the drink is poisonous or not? And the hardest problem of all will still remain. The human race is free to love the buggers because they think the buggers all are dead. You are still alive, and so they're still afraid of you."
Human stood among them and gestured toward his body as if it were a weak and feeble thing.
"Of us?
They're afraid of the same thing you fear when you look up and see the stars fill up with humans. They're afraid that someday they'll come to a world and find that you have got there first."
"We don't want to be there first," said Human. "We want to be there too."
"Then give me time," said the speaker. "Teach me who you are so that I can teach them."
"Anything," said Human.
He looked around at the others.
"We'll teach you anything."
Leafeater stood up. He spoke in the male's language, but Mito understood him.
"Some things aren't yours to teach."
Human answered him sharply and in stark.
"What Pipo and Lebo and Wanda and Mito taught us wasn't theirs to teach either, but they taught us."
"Their foolishness doesn't have to be our foolishness," Leafeater still spoke in male's language.
"Nor does their wisdom necessarily apply to us," Human retorted.
Then Leafeater said something in tree language that Mito could not understand. Human made no answer, and Leafeater walked away. As he left, Wanda returned, her eyes red from crying. Human turned back to the speaker.
"What do you want to know?" he asked. "We'll tell you. We'll show you if we can."
Speaker, in turn, looked at Miro and Wanda. "What should I ask them? I know so little that I don't know what we need to know." Miro looked at Wanda.
"You have no stone or metal tools," she said, "but your house is made of wood, and so are your bows and arrows."
Human stood, waiting. The silence lengthened.
"But what is your question?"
Human finally said. How could he have missed the connection, Miro thought.
"We humans," said Speaker, "use tools of stone or metal to cut down trees when we want to shape them into houses or arrows or clubs like the ones I see some of you carrying."
It took a moment for the speaker's words to sink in. Then suddenly all the piggies were on their feet. They began running around madly, purposelessly, sometimes bumping into each other or into trees or the log houses. Most of them were silent. But now and then one of them would wail exactly as they had cried out a few minutes ago. It was eerie, the almost silent insanity of the piggies, as if they had suddenly lost control of their bodies. All the years of careful non-communication, refraining from telling the piggies anything, and now Speaker breached that policy, and the result was this madness. Human emerged from the chaos and threw himself to the ground in front of Speaker.
"Oh, Speaker," he cried loudly. "Promise that you'll never let them cut my father Rooter with their stone and metal tools. If you want to murder someone, there are ancient brothers who will give themselves, or I will gladly die. But don't let them kill my father."
"Or my father," cried the other piggies, "or mine." We would never have planted Ruter so close to the fence, said Mandashuva, if we had known you were Varelse.
Speaker raised his hands again. Has any human cut a tree in Lusitania? Never. The law here forbids it. You have nothing to fear from us.
There was a silence as the piggies became still. Finally, Human picked himself up from the ground.
You've made us fear humans all the more, he said to Speaker. I wish you had never come to our forest.
Wanda's voice rang out above his.
How can you say that after the way you murdered my father?
Human looked at her with astonishment, unable to answer. Miro put his arm around Wanda's shoulders, and the speaker for the dead spoke into the silence.
You promised me that you'd answer all my questions. I ask you now, how do you build a house made of wood, and the bow and arrows that this one carries, and those clubs? We've told you the only way we know. You tell me another way, the way you do it.
The brother gives himself, said Human.
I told you. We tell the ancient brother of our need, and we show him the shape, and he gives himself.
Can we see how it's done? Said Ender.
Human looked around at the other piggies.
You want us to ask a brother to give himself just so you can see it? We don't need a new house, not for years yet, and we have all the arrows we need.
Show him!
Miro turned, as the others also turned, to see Leaf Eater re-emerging from the forest. He walked purposefully into the middle of the clearing. He did not look at them, and he spoke as if he were a herald, a town crier, not caring whether anyone was listening to him or not. He spoke in the wives' language, and Miro could understand only bits and pieces.
What is he saying?
Whispered the speaker. Miro, still kneeling beside him, translated as best he could.
He went to the wives, apparently, and they said to do whatever you asked.
But it isn't that simple. He's telling them that, I don't know these words, something about all of them dying. Something about brothers dying, anyway. Look at them. They aren't afraid, any of them.
I don't know what their fear looks like, said Speaker. I don't know these people at all.
I don't either, said Miro. I've got to hand it to you. You've caused more excitement here in half an hour than I've seen in years of coming here.
It's a gift I was born with, said the Speaker. I'll make you a bargain. I won't tell anybody about your questionable activities, and you don't tell anybody who I am.
That's easy, said Miro. I don't believe it anyway.
Leaf Eater's speech ended. He immediately padded to the house and went inside.
We'll ask for the gift of an ancient brother, said Human. The wives have said so.
So it was that Miro stood with his arm around Wanda and the speaker standing at his other side as the piggies performed a miracle far more convincing than any of the ones that had won old Gusto and Sida their title Os Venerados. The piggies gathered in a circle around a thick old tree at the clearing's edge. Then, one by one, each piggy shimmied up the tree and began beating on it with a club. Soon they were all in the tree, singing and pounding out complex rhythms.
Father tongue, Wanda whispered.
After only a few minutes of this, the tree tilted noticeably. Immediately, about half the piggies jumped down and began pushing the tree so it would fall into the open ground of the clearing. The rest began beating all the more furiously and singing all the louder. One by one, the great branches of the tree began to fall off. Immediately, piggies ran out and picked them up, dragged them away from the area where the tree was meant to fall. Human carried one to the speaker, who took it carefully and showed it to Mito and Wanda. The raw end, where it had been attached to the tree, was absolutely smooth. It wasn't flat, the surface undulated slightly along an oblique angle, but there was no raggedness to it, no leaking sap, nothing to imply the slightest violence in its separation from the tree. Miro touched his finger to it, and it was cold and smooth as marble. Finally, the tree was a single straight trunk, nude and majestic. The pale patches where branches once had grown were brightly lit by the afternoon sun. The singing reached a climax, then stopped. The tree tilted, and then began a smooth and graceful fall to the earth. The ground shook and thundered when it struck, and then all was still. Human walked to the fallen tree and began to stroke its surface, singing softly. The bark split gradually under his hands. The crack extended itself up and down the length of the tree until the bark was split completely in half. Then many piggies took hold of it and prized it from the trunk. It came away on one side and the other in two continuous sheets of bark. The bark was carried to the side. "Have you ever seen them use the bark?" Speaker asked Miro. Miro shook his head. He had no words to say aloud. Now Arrow stepped forward, singing softly. He drew his fingers up and down the trunk, as if tracing exactly the length and width of a single bow. Miro saw how lines appeared, how the naked wood creased, split, crumbled until only the bow remained, perfect and polished and smooth, lying in a long trench in the wood. Other piggies came forward, drawing shapes on the trunk and singing. They came away with clubs, with bows and arrows, thin-bladed knives, and thousands of strands of thin basket wood. Finally, when half the trunk was dissipated, they all stepped back and sang together. The tree shivered and split into half a dozen long poles. The tree was entirely used up. Human walked slowly forward and knelt by the poles, his hands gently resting on the nearest one. He tilted back his head and began to sing, a wordless melody that was the saddest sound that Miro had ever heard. The song went on and on, Human's voice alone. Only gradually did Miro realize that the other piggies were looking at him, waiting for something. Finally, Mandashuva came to him and spoke softly. "Please," he said, "it's only right that you should sing for the brother." "I don't know how," said Miro, feeling helpless and afraid.
"He gave his life," said Mandashuva. "To answer your question."
"To answer my question and then raise 1,000 more," Miro said silently. But he walked forward, knelt beside Human, curled his fingers around the same cold, smooth pole that Human held, tilted back his head, and let his voice come out. At first weak and hesitant, unsure what melody to sing, but soon he understood the reason for the tuneless song, felt the death of the tree under his hands, and his voice became loud and strong, making agonized disharmonies with Human's voice that mourned the death of the tree and thanked it for its sacrifice and promised to use its death for the good of the tribe, for the good of the brothers and the wives and the children, so that all would live and thrive and prosper. That was the meaning of the song, and the meaning of the death of the tree, and when the song was finally over, Miro bent until his forehead touched the wood, and he said the words of extreme unction, the same words he had whispered over Libo's corpse on the hillside 5 years ago.
Chapter 15. Speaking. Human. Why don't any of the other humans ever come see us? Miro. We're the only ones allowed to come through the gate. Human, why don't they just climb over the fence? Miro, haven't any of you ever touched the fence? Human does not answer. It's very painful to touch the fence. To pass over the fence would be like every part of your body hurting as bad as possible all at once. Human, that's stupid. Isn't there grass on both sides? Wanda Kenyatta Figuera Mukumbi. Dialogue transcripts, 103-0-1970-1-1-5.
The sun was only an hour from the horizon when Mayor Bosquinha climbed the stairs to Bishop Peregrino's private office in the cathedral. Dom and Donna Cristans were already there, looking grave. Bishop Peregrino, however, looked pleased with himself. He always enjoyed it when all the political and religious leadership of Milagre was gathered under his roof. Never mind that Bosquinha was the one who called the meeting and then offered to have it at the cathedral because she was the one with the skimmer. Peregrino liked the feeling that he was somehow the master of Lusitania Colony. Well, by the end of this meeting, it would be plain to them all that no one in this room was the master of anything. Bosquinha greeted them all. She did not sit down in the offered chair, however. Instead, she sat before the bishop's own terminal, logged in, and ran the program she had prepared. In the air above the terminal, there appeared several layers of tiny cubes. The highest layer had only a few cubes. Most of the layers had many, many more. More than half of the layers, starting with the very highest, were colored red. The rest were blue.
"Very pretty," said Bishop Peregrino.
Bosquinha looked over at Dom Cristán. "Do you recognize the model?" He shook his head.
"But I think I know what this meeting is about."
Donna Cristán leaned forward on her chair. "Is there any safe place where we can hide the things we want to keep?" Bishop Peregrino's expression of detached amusement vanished from his face.
"I don't know what this meeting is about."
Bosquinha turned around on her stool to face him. "I was very young when I was appointed to be governor of the new Lusitania colony. It was a great honor to be chosen, a great trust. I had studied government in communities and social systems since my childhood, and I had done well in my short career in Oporto. What the committee apparently overlooked was the fact that I was already suspicious, deceptive, and chauvinistic."
"These are virtues of yours that we have all come to admire," said Bishop Peregrino.
Bosquinha smiled. "My chauvinism meant that as soon as Lusitania colony was mine, I became more loyal to the interests of Lusitania than to the interests of the Hundred Worlds or Starways Congress. My deceptiveness led me to pretend to the committee that, on the contrary, I had the best interests of Congress at heart at all times. And my suspicion led me to believe that Congress was not likely to give Lusitania anything remotely like independent and equal status among the Hundred Worlds."
"Of course not," said Bishop Peregrino. "We are a colony."
"We are not a colony," said Bosquinha. "We are an experiment. I examined our charter and license and all the congressional orders pertaining to us, and I discovered that the normal privacy laws did not apply to us. I discovered that the committee had the power of unlimited access to all the memory files of every person and institution on Lusitania." The bishop began to look angry.
"Do you mean that the committee has the right to look in the confidential files of the church?"
"Ah," said Bosquinha, "a fellow chauvinist."
"The church has some rights under the Starways Code."
"Don't be angry with me."
"You never told me."
"If I had told you, you would have protested, and they would have pretended to back down, and then I couldn't have done what I did."
"Which is?"
"This program. It monitors all Ansible-initiated accesses to any files in Lusitania Colony." Dom Cristán chuckled.
"You're not supposed to do that."
"I know. As I said, I have many secret vices. But my program never found any major intrusion. Oh, a few files each time the piggies killed one of our xenologers, that was to be expected, but nothing major until 4 days ago."
"When the speaker for the dead arrived,"
said Bishop Peregrino.
Bosquinha was amused that the bishop obviously regarded the speaker's arrival as such a landmark date that he instantly made such a connection.
3 days ago," said Bosquinha, "a non-destructive scan was initiated by Ansible. It followed an interesting pattern." She turned to the terminal and changed the display. Now it showed accesses primarily in high-level areas, and limited to only one region of the display. It accessed everything to do with the xenologers and xenobiologists of Milagre. It ignored all security routines as if they didn't exist. Everything they discovered and everything to do with their personal lives. And yes, Bishop Peregrino, I believed at the time, and I believe today, that this had to do with the speaker.
"Surely he has no authority with Starways Congress," said the bishop.
Dom Cristán nodded wisely.
"San Angelo once wrote in his private journals, which no one but the children of the mind ever read."
The bishop turned on him with glee.
"So the children of the mind do have secret writings of San Angelo.
Not secret, said Donna Cristin. Merely boring. Anyone can read the journals, but we're the only ones who bother. What he wrote, said Dom Cristin, was that Speaker Andrew is older than we know. Older than Starway's Congress, and in his own way, perhaps more powerful. Bishop Peregrino snorted. He's a boy. Can't be 40 years old yet.
Your stupid rivalries are wasting time, said Busquinha sharply. I called this meeting because of an emergency. As a courtesy to you, because I have already acted for the benefit of the government of Lusitania.
The others fell silent. Busquinha returned the terminal to the original display. This morning my program alerted me for a second time. Another systematic Ansible access. Only this time, it was not the selective, non-destructive access of 3 days ago. This time, it is reading everything at data transfer speed, which implies that all our files are being copied into off-world computers. Then the directories are rewritten so that a single Ansible-initiated command will completely destroy every single file in our computer memories. Busquinha could see that Bishop Peregrino was surprised, and the children of the mind were not.
Why, said Bishop Peregrino, to destroy all our files? This is what you do to a nation or a world that is in rebellion, that you wish to destroy, that you...
I see, said Busquinha to the children of the mind, that you also were chauvinistic and suspicious.
Well, much more narrowly than you, I'm afraid, said Dom Cristam. But we also detected the intrusions. We, of course, copied all our records at great expense to the monasteries of the Children of the Mind on other worlds, and they will try to restore our files after they are stripped. However, if we are being treated as a rebellious colony, I doubt that such a restoration will be permitted. So we are also making paper copies of the most vital information. There is no hope of printing everything, but we think we may be able to print out enough to get by so that our work isn't utterly destroyed.
You knew this? Said the bishop.
And you didn't tell me?
Forgive me, Bishop Peregrino, but it did not occur to us that you would not have detected this yourselves.
And you also don't believe we do any work that is important enough to be worth printing out to save?
Enough, said Mayor Busquinha. Printouts can't save more than a tiny percentage. There aren't enough printers in Lusitania to make a dent in the problem. We couldn't even maintain basic services. I don't think we have more than an hour left before the copying is complete and they are able to wipe out our memory. But even if we began this morning when the intrusion started, we could not have printed out more than 0.01% of the files that we access every day. Our fragility, our vulnerability is complete.
So we're helpless, said the bishop.
No, but I wanted to make clear to you the extremity of our situation, so that you would accept the only alternative. It will be very distasteful to you.
I have no doubt of that, said Bishop Peregrino.
An hour ago, when I was wrestling with this problem, trying to see if there was any class of files that might be immune to this treatment, I discovered that, in fact, there was one person whose files were being completely overlooked. At first, I thought it was because he was a Framling, but the reason is much more subtle than that. The Speaker for the Dead has no files in Lusitanian memory.
None?
Impossible, said Donna Cristin. He is invisible to Starway's Congress. If they place an embargo on all data transfers to and from Lusitania, his files will still be accessible because the computers do not see his file accesses as data transfers. They are original storage, yet they are not in Lusitanian memory.
Are you suggesting, said Bishop Peregrino, that we transfer our most confidential and important files as messages to that unspeakable infidel?
I am telling you that I have already done exactly that. The transfer of the most vital and sensitive government files is almost complete. It was a high-priority transfer at local speeds, so it runs much faster than the congressional copying. I am offering you a chance to make a similar transfer, using my highest priority so that it takes precedence over all other local computer usage. If you don't want to do it, fine. I'll use my priority to transfer the second tier of government files. But he could look in our files, said the bishop. Yes, he could. Dom Cristin shook his head.
He won't if we ask him not to. You are naive as a child, said Bishop Pellegrino. There would be nothing to compel him even to give the data back to us.
Bosquinha nodded. That's true. He'll have everything that's vital to us, and he can keep it or return it as he wishes. But I believe, as Dom Cristan does, that he's a good man who'll help us in our time of need. Donna Cristan stood. Excuse me, she said. I'd like to begin crucial transfers immediately. Bosquinha turned to the bishop's terminal and logged into her own high-priority mode. Just enter the classes of files that you want to send into Speaker Andrew's message queue. I assume you already have them prioritized since you were printing them out.
How long do we have? Asked Dom Cristin. Donna Cristin was already typing furiously.
The time is here at the top. Bosquinha put her hand into the holographic display and touched the countdown numbers with her finger.
Don't bother transferring anything that we've already printed, said Dom Cristin. We can always type that back in. There's precious little of it anyway.
Bosquinha turned to the bishop. I knew this would be difficult.
The bishop gave one derisive laugh. Difficult.
I hope you'll consider carefully before rejecting this.
Rejecting it? Said the bishop. Do you think I'm a fool? I may detest the pseudo-religion of these blasphemous speakers for the dead, but if this is the only way God has opened for us to preserve the vital records of the church, then I'd be a poor servant of the Lord if I let pride stop me from using it. Our files aren't prioritized yet, and it will take a few minutes, but I trust that the children of the mine will leave us enough time for our data transfers.
How much time will you need, do you think? Asked Dom Cristin.
Well, not much. 10 minutes at the most, I think.
Bosquinha was surprised, and pleasantly so. She had been afraid the bishop would insist on copying all his files before allowing the children of the mine to go ahead. Just one more attempt to assert the precedence of the bishopric over the monastery. Thank you, Dom Cristin said, kissing the hand that Pellegrino extended to him. The bishop looked at Bosquinha coldly.
You don't need to look surprised, Mayor Bosquinha. The children of the mind work with the knowledge of the world, so they depend far more on the world's machines. Mother Church works with things of the spirit, so our use of public memory is merely clerical. As for the Bible, we are so old-fashioned and set in our ways that we still keep dozens of leather-bound paper copies in the cathedral. Starways Congress can't steal from us our copies of the Word of God.
He smiled. Maliciously, of course. Bosquinha smiled back quite cheerfully.
A small matter, said Dom Cristin. After our files are destroyed, and we copy them back into memory from the speaker's files, what is to stop Congress from doing it again, and again, and again?
That is the difficult decision, said Bosquinha.
What we do depends on what Congress is trying to accomplish. Maybe they won't actually destroy our files at all. Maybe they'll immediately restore our most vital files after this demonstration of their power. Since I have no idea why they're disciplining us, how can I guess how far this will go? If they leave us any way to remain loyal, then of course we must also remain vulnerable to further discipline. But if, for some reason, they are determined to treat us like rebels...
Well, if bad came to worst, we could copy everything back into local memory and then... cut off the Ansible. God help us, said Donna Cristin. We would be utterly alone. Bishop Peregrino looked annoyed.
What an absurd idea, Sister de Thistio Picado. Or do you think that Christ depends upon the ansible? That Congress has the power to silence the Holy Ghost?
Donna Cristam blushed and returned to her work at the terminal. The bishop's secretary handed him a paper with a list of files on it.
You can leave my personal correspondence off the list, said the bishop. I've already sent my messages. We'll let the church decide which of my letters is worth preserving. They have no value to me.
The bishop is ready, said Dom Cristan. Immediately his wife arose from the terminal, and the secretary took her place. By the way, said Busquinha, I thought you'd want to know. The speaker has announced that this evening in the Praça, he'll speak the death of Marcos Maria Ribeira. Busquinha looked at her watch. Very soon now, in fact.
Why, said the bishop acidly, did you think that I would care?
I thought you might want to send a representative.
Thank you for telling us, said Dom Cristan. I think that I'll attend. I'd like to hear a speaking by the man who spoke the death of San Angelo.
He turned to the bishop.
I'll report to you on what he says, if you like. The bishop leaned back and smiled tightly. Thank you. But one of my people will be in attendance.
Busquinha left the bishop's office and clattered down the stairs and out the cathedral doors. She had to be back in her own rooms now, because whatever the Congress was planning, it would be Busquinha who received their messages. She had not discussed it with the religious leaders because it was really none of their business, but she knew perfectly well, at least in a general way, why Congress was doing this. The paragraphs that gave Congress the right to treat Lusitania like a rebellious colony were all tied to the rules dealing with contact with the piggies. Obviously, the xenologers had done something grossly wrong. Since Busquinha had not known of any violations, it had to be something so big that its evidence showed up on the satellites, the only monitoring devices that reported directly to the committee without passing through Busquinha's hands. Busquinha had tried to think of what Miro and Wanda might have done. Start a forest fire? Cut down trees? Led a war between the piggy tribes? Anything she thought of sounded absurd. She tried to call them in to question them, but they were gone, of course. Through the gate, out into the forest to continue, no doubt, the same activities that had brought the possibility of destruction to Lusitania colony. Busquinha kept reminding herself that they were young, that it might all be some ridiculous juvenile mistake. But they weren't that young, and they were two of the brightest minds in a colony that contained many intelligent people. It was a very good thing that governments under the Starways Code were forbidden to own any instruments of punishment that might be used for torture. For the first time in her life, Busquinha felt such fury that she might use such instruments if she had them.
I don't know what you thought you were doing, Miro and Wanda, and I don't know what you did, but whatever your purpose might have been, this whole community will pay the price for it. And somehow, if there were any justice, I would make you pay it back.